This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you guys doing this evening?
Good.
Very well.
All's well. Jen's planting things in Virginia. We're preparing for the Holocaust.
Yes, I just plant things. That's what I do.
That's right. It's all good. All right.
Yeah. I've added crazy plant lady to my many job descriptions.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, good.
Well, you can eat the plants. If you're a crazy cat lady, you can't really eat the cats. So
exactly. Right. Exactly. You'd have to, there's a whole different level of crazy going on there. So
yeah, well, Nathan, you and I, we're going to go meet her plants here in a couple weeks.
That's very
right.
True.
You guys are coming out.
That's right.
Yeah, I can't wait. I've never been in such cold before. And for the listeners who have not heard, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk are doing a seminar called a True to Life seminar. You can learn more about it at www.truetolife.us, and you can register, watch the seminar. It's going to be an all day event on a Sunday, the 19th, and so it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yep. All
yeah,
good.
Yeah. And it's strange, you know, Virginia in mid or late February is a total crapshoot because it could be extreme winter weather or it could be extremely spring-like. We have no idea what we're going to get. So
right.
It's an adventure.
Spin the wheel. Yeah. You got it.
Exactly.
But we'll get to see Jen's plants.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right now it's really pleasant. It was a nice day to be out there. You know, planting things and planning out where more plants can go.
Yep.
And cool. Bunnies too. Did I hear it right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I have now brought the number of animals in the house to 10 because there are two bunnies that have recently joined the pack.
But the bunnies will eat the plants.
Well, the bunnies are employees.
Yeah.
They're compost producers.
Got it.
So the thing with guinea pig and bunny compost is that it's not what's called hot compost, which means that it has to, or manure, which has to kind of, you know, fester for a while before you can put it on your garden beds or on your plants. Bunny droppings and guinea pig droppings are ready to put right on your garden. They're ready to go. It's ideal fertilizer for a garden. So,
oh, wow. Gee.
Is that B12? I mean, that's all I really know. Is that what that is?
It probably gives you some B12 too, especially if you're eating those carrots right out of the soil. So that's really, they just kind of accelerate the whole cycle of life, you know, the sort of way they, I grow the greens, they eat the greens, they poop out the greens, that goes back on the garden to grow more greens.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, that's what we're up to here.
Oh, well, speaking of improving the cycle of life, we've got a very interesting question for today's show. And
nice segue, Nate.
Yeah. Thank you. And so this is a topic I don't know very much about, other than I've heard a few words that I've heard the term eugenics, when it was used in, you know, World War II, or, you know, during the Nazi kind of, rise to power. Dr. LaHawk, I'm sure we'll hear more about this from the political side, but also Dr. Lyle with the psychological side, and kind of all blending those things together. So the question is as follows. Dear doctors, I'm curious about an unpopular subject, systematic eugenics. Has random selection in the regular mating market already produced the best possible human genes combinations at some point in history? Or, with the systematic program of human breeding, could we generate humans with drastically higher IQ, strength, size, speed, athleticism, beauty, etc.? What do you think is the hypothetical limit of human genetic potential for outlier individuals and for the average of a population? This kind of discussion is often obscured by the obvious practical and ethical problems involved in implementing such a program, rather than how well it might be able to work and what it could theoretically achieve.
Yeah, it's kind of a... go ahead.
Fortunately for everybody, it doesn't work very well, so you can't you can't actually do this. But yes, this is an interesting topic, and we'll let Doug dive in. But my top line sort of answer to this anytime this comes up is you humans are not Brussels sprouts. You can't engage in some sort of breeding program to select in this simplistic way for ideal genes that you might like to concentrate in the population and create a master race. It doesn't work, and that's probably a very fortunate thing for all involved. But yeah. It sounded like Doug was going to launch into this too.
Yeah, I don't know that much about it, except that in reading Blueprint, I learned some things that I didn't know. And interestingly enough, with that book written in about 2020, he was covering things that clearly Jeffrey Miller didn't know as a result of 2015. As of 2015, about that time, sometime in the last 10 years, Miller was writing about how the Chinese were doing essentially this. They had isolated a gene that was associated with very high IQs, and they were essentially probably aiming at some selective breeding programs to try to create a master brilliant race. It turns out it's going to fail. And the reason why is what Plumman and others have discovered is that traits of any significant thing that you're going to measure on are actually, they're being carried in tiny, tiny little variances where the typical gene is responsible for less than 1/100th of the variants, less than 1/100th of a percent.
Less than that.
Yeah. In other words, 1/10,000th of the variants is covered by a single gene. And so, so therefore there's going to be no way. So even if you found a single gene that happens to be sitting inside of your extremely high IQ people, that single gene is probably at most responsible for a quarter of an IQ point. So it just happens to be carrying along with a whole bunch of suites of other genes, and those suites of other genes are randomly distributed all over Hell's Half Acre. They're not all consistently sitting inside your high IQ people. And so it turns out, to show you how problematic this is, we certainly, each and every one of us, is a dedicated eugenicist. In other words, when you go out for a date, you're practicing eugenics. When you look at the photography, when you read the profile, when you talk to the person and you look at their twisted teeth, everything about you is scanning for gene quality, including their sense of humor, how easy they are with the waitress, how generous they are or not. Everything about a person, you are scanning, 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 calculating, calculating, calculating. You can't help yourself. That's why this machine, you know, has 2 trillion data bits per second flowing through this thing, is to run exactly these extraordinarily complex calculations that are, in fact, impossibly complex when it comes to try to analyzing these things gene by gene, because it isn't that you just have 30,000 genes. You have 30,000 genes interacting. Each of those genes is interacting with another 5,000 genes. So the formula and the pathway of causality in the genetic code is spectacularly complicated. And the dream of the genome project from 25 years ago was that, you know, we're going to find one gene for one, you know, for one outcome, one manifestation, or what we call a phenotype. In other words, one gene, one phenotype. Those exist in nature, but they're not going to exist in complex human characteristics. So they may exist in, for example, whether you can roll your tongue upside down. That is possibly a single gene potentially. But anything else as complicated as IQ, you can forget it. And so the, uh, or God forbid, beauty, size, strength, speed, athleticism. You look at LeBron James's kid, Bronny, who's a hell of a fine young basketball player. And LeBron desperately wants to play in the NBA with Bronny because he just thinks it would be super cool. But the truth is that Bronny's, you know, 6'2 and a half. And there's all kinds of that level of athleticism in 6'2 and a half young men all over the world. And Bronny James is not in that class, it wouldn't appear. So, I mean, I think he's going to be a very, very good, solid, you know, Division I basketball player. But if he plays in the NBA, it'll be an unbelievably heavy-handed, nepotistic fiasco, I believe. I could be wrong. The jury isn't out on what will happen to this young man in terms of his development because we don't know what's in the genes yet. He's only about 18 years old. So,
but we can look at other similar examples. You
right.
know, Einstein's kids.
Right.
Or, you know, it's just on down the line. You take sort of extreme examples of human characteristics.
Yes.
And you have this inference. Imagine what their kids will be like. And their kids are very mediocre.
Right.
You know, just again and again and again.
Yeah. It turns out that two random members of the population, their IQs differ by 17 points. Okay, so that's just literally walk down the street, point at some guy, point at some gal, bring him into a room, test him. Those two random individuals will be 17 points apart. Two siblings who share 50% of their genes, for God's sakes, are 13 points apart.
So basically the same. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They are,
which is amazing.
Yes, absolutely amazing that's true. I had no idea that it was that much of a crapshoot. Although when I was lamenting not having children, my friend, infamous friend Larry, said, "You need to remember Albert Maleev Einstein."
Yeah, but it's not like you're depriving the world of your brilliant children.
actually, Jen, I was more thinking about my beauty.
I'm sorry. Well, that goes without saying.
But yes, exactly. So Albert Maleev, Einstein went through a couple wives, but one of them was an utterly brilliant mathematician who literally was his co-founder in relativity. And this woman, they had a kid, and it winds up, you know, this is what Larry cheerfully describes as a duster. And so Larry has likened selective breeding to the equivalent of wildcatting for oil in West Texas. In other words, you might get a gusher and get rich, or you might get a duster and get nothing.
And given that is true, it is interesting. Yes. That we are so devoted to idealizing and to pursuing perfection. And in your words, we're all devoted eugenicists.
Yes.
In the dating market, because you are doing that because of your reproductive goals. But ultimately, you're spinning the wheel. You know, you're sort of optimizing your chances by finding the best possible mate.
Right.
But you know, it's no guarantee that
right.
you're going to wind up with a winner by any means.
Absolutely. And this is which then gets down to our last message from my friendship group, the famous quote from Ana Rial. My friend Ana Rial, don't breed with freaks.
Don't breed with freaks.
The thing is that just as you optimize your chances by breeding with pleasant, attractive, intelligent people, and you cross your fingers and hope for the best. If you are looking at somebody and they've got a great look to them, but they got one hell of a temper, or they've got one hell of a streak in there that is bizarre, careful. Okay, you are absolutely tilting the wheel against yourself. So that is just something to keep in mind. But the grand program of eugenics is at this moment completely beyond any reasonable human capacity to make any hay out of it. And that's because of the not only obviously the slow generational processes of humans. These aren't plants that you can have a new generation every year or so. The but the other problems are that the things that we find so fancy about people are not a single characteristic of a pea plant. This isn't Mendelian genetics. This is extraordinarily, vastly more complicated and piecemeal than we ever thought. So that's why you basically have done exactly what this person is saying. In other words, has our own natural, essentially a sort of mating and mate selection resulted in probably the, as outstanding of an outlier as you would ever see. And the answer is, yeah, I think that's true. In other words, I don't think that through any selective breeding program anywhere in the next 500 years, you're going to get something smarter than Einstein or Aristotle. In other words, it was interesting at one point, sometime in the last 20 years, there was some super complicated computer models that had gone into looking at human speed. And it turned out that all of the great human sprinters, all the way back to Jesse Owens, that none of them were faster than Jesse Owens, which was really, really interesting. And until Usain Bolt comes along, okay? And Usain Bolt is, in fact, a once-in-a-century outlier. But pretty much everybody else was sitting right on top of Jesse Owens, somebody that we saw emerge in 1936. So I think that that's what you're going to find. You know, are you ever going to create a better mathematician than you know, Gauss? I don't think so. So the are we going to see a better athlete than Michael Jordan? No, I don't think so. So I think these outliers are thrown out, you know, one in a billion at a time. And you're not going to triple that by trying to hone in on one characteristic, because the characteristics are too complicated in their genetic composite nature.
Wow.
This doesn't stop the, you know, the research from happening, of
right.
course.
So, sure.
I mean, this is still a goal of the Chinese regime, for sure. They're the most open about it, and, you know, throughout the world. And it's an aspiration, too, of CRISPR technology and, mm-hmm. you know, sort of let's see if we can rearrange some genes in embryonic state and see if we can improve this, you know, sort of a Gattaca style mm-hmm. Approach to designer baby creation. So I think there's a desire and an aspiration for this. And if it could be pulled off, of course, it would give a nation state, you know, incredible advantages over their enemies. And so it continues to be lavishly funded and pursued. You know, ethical boundaries on that research be damned. So, it's not the idea is not going anywhere.
These people are so bizarre. You know, human nature just never changes. So, you see these bizarre dominance hierarchy crazy shit going on. The truth is, the people that are trying to cook this thing up are going to be long since dead. Mm-hmm. and the truth is, any little effects that they have are you know, any such thing are just completely going to get washed away by the vicissitudes of history. So the whole thing is insane. The one thing that I could say about the gene technology and so forth is that when there is a single problem with a single gene, that's different than adding genius by one gene. You can't do that. But what you can do is you can destroy the functioning of a part of the body with one gene gone bad. And this is where genetic engineering is potentially going to be fantastic, in something like Huntington's chorea. Okay, so if they can go in, you know, in a very early embryonic state and alter the genetic code of somebody that would have Huntington's, that is a miraculous, you know, Nobel Prize worthy innovation. So there, you know, there's going to be things like that, but people need to understand those are two entirely different kinds of processes, where one thing, it's like, you know, building a Lamborghini versus fixing the little thing wrong that's wrong with the Lamborghini.
Buffing out a dent, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. In other words.
Yeah, completely different.
Completely different. One little mistake can cause a catastrophe that we might be able to fix. You know, 1,000, quote, fixes isn't going to improve the thing a bit. Yeah. And that's where genes and eugenics sit at this state in history.
Wow. Thank you for clarifying. It's so odd to hear people criticizing evolutionary psychology. Maybe not so much today, but I know when we first started the podcast, I would get comments from people saying, "Oh no, this is going to lead to eugenics," and they didn't quite understand. It was just a way to disparage ideas that people they didn't really like hearing. But it's odd to me to hear that there's people trying to do this, understanding that everybody's out there for their own separate interests. And it's like, let's suppose they did discover eugenics. It wouldn't benefit them in any way, unless, you know, other than just giving them some status so they might be able to get a fancier mate themselves. But it's just so odd that they're trying to, quote, you know, they're in the group trap of Harry Brown, that they're trying to improve the lot of the group.
Well, why do men go die in war? You know, there's no great personal advantage there, but there's the, you know, the accrued status for dying for your country and advancing the cause and leaving something better for your children. And, you know, I think with something like this, there's a whole other set of rewards and signals that come with it, where you're engaged in very important research, you're chasing the Nobel Prize or other prizes and other scientific accolades. And there's also monetary incentives. So, you know, the next big thing is to be able to edit out these kinds of single gene mutations, or these relatively simple mutations that Doug is talking about, and that's a, you know, there's a lot of money wrapped up with that. So if you're a lab that is doing that kind of work, there's going to be an incentive to get a piece of that money pie by doing all sorts of genetic research. And so there's also like, hey, this is job security. This is a way to line my nest in this life and the next.
Yeah, so, you know what? We can work on mutations of viruses.
Sure. Yeah. Let's just combine all of those things and yes, have lots of virtue to flash around.
Yep. And pretty soon we're selling cruise stock short. Yeah, that's how it's done. All right, Nathan, let's see what else we got.
All right. Thank you so much. Okay, our next topic is a little bit darker, but it's about suicide. So
darker than eugenics.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah,
you got quite a lineup for us here.
Yeah. dear doctors, I heard a really good talk that you did on suicide and being there and really listening to someone who threatens or mentions it. However, this is going to sound insensitive, but my husband's daughter is extremely disagreeable. She's low conscientiousness, low intelligence, highly introverted, open to drugs and alcohol only, and highly unstable, all like her mother, but much worse. She's in constant crisis, multiple calls throughout the day and night, on the tiniest of issues, and is constantly mentioning or threatening suicide. My husband and I have really tried to be there for her, and we never miss a phone call, but her constant cries for attention are draining and exhausting and have taken years off of our lives. She's in her early 20s and says that she probably won't be around after age 25. So we're terrified to go anywhere, to go on vacation, go out of town. My husband fears turning off his phone and is even afraid to go to work and miss a phone call. She had a suicide attempt several years ago where she took a sleeping pill that she knew didn't work and where she had access to much more and much stronger medication and sleeping pills. She had a cutting episode, same thing, scratches with a couple drops of blood. She accuses us of not doing anything either time. Totally untrue. She was hospitalized both times after fights with us. But the fear on our side and the accusations and threats on hers remain. I don't want to discount anything that she says or anything that she's feeling, but my and my husband's health and mental health and bank account in order for him to try to buy her happiness and get rid of the unjustified guilt and his debilitating fear, we're both really suffering and we don't know what to do.
Better call me. Complicated, very complicated question. And what we have is we've got people being held hostage here and what you need to be maneuvered into. You need to be educated into what's what I call a position of power. So a position of power is that that you essentially do things correctly and reasonably, and you are that you essentially have examined the landscape of what it is that can reasonably be done, and then you execute your life from a position of power in that you can that you make peace with whatever happens. So the right thing to do is to learn about the nature of suicide, why the individual is actually essentially mouthing suicidal communications, why they may have suicidal thoughts and actually suicidal impulses, and the reasons for that are there's a couple of different major reasons. There's genetic variation that will lead people down this pathway. In other words, there's going to be people that they're more conducive or with suicide than others. However, a big part of it is also that the person is essentially they're trying to figure out the adaptive unconscious is attempting to try to figure out whether or not that the gene pool is better off without them or not. And so when people feel suicidal, if they are seriously thinking about this, they will make suicidal gestures and noises and communications in order to essentially pull the brains of those that are close to them. The reason they want to do this is that they're attempting to triangulate on what the truth is about their value to the gene pool. If they are in fact a net negative to the gene pool, then it may be in their best interest to take themselves out genetically. So this is a strange upside down way, but we can only arrive here through understanding selfish gene theory. That organisms are, Dawkins wrote The Selfish Gene in order to understand a very specific problem. That problem is of altruism. How can you have an altruistic behavior out of an organism that should be ultimately self-serving? And the answer is the organism isn't self-serving. The genes are self-serving. The organism itself is expendable. Okay, so therefore, you can derive out of this suicidality. If I think that my presence is actually a net negative to my gene pool because I'm a big drain on everybody's resources, okay, I have evidence that this is true. People interact with me in ways that they are disgusted, annoyed, frustrated, angry, in other words, unhappy. That people aren't happy about seeing me, and they're not happy about interacting with me, and they are irritated about provisioning me. In other words, if I get all kinds of evidence that I, you know, and nobody's happy about my work, my contributions, etc. In other words, if I basically don't get any esteem signals, and I get indications from my gene pool that I'm actually a net negative, then it would make sense for the organism to have suicide circuitry that would be built into the genetic code that would essentially tell the organism, you know what, your genes are better off without you alive. Okay. Well, I have no doubt that some of this circuitry, you know, is built in each and every one of us, but it requires an extraordinary set of data points to come in and activate it. Okay. Now, this gal sounds like she's got it. Okay, so she's you know ineffective in many ways in her life through largely no fault of her own. She got dealt one hell of a hand, and as a result, she's making inferences that says, "Wow, looks like I'm worthless." Okay, and she's getting feedback from certainly the father that says, "No, you're not. You know, gosh, we're taking your phone call. You're really important." So you're doing everything you can that you can figure out how to do in order to contradict the other messages that she's receiving and that she's interpreting in this way. And so what we have is a, you know, that's part of what we got. Now, doesn't look too serious. In other words, the person actually looks like they got a disagreeable streak that is actually not not so heavily weighted toward an altruistic interpretation of this. The sort of half-baked little suicide gestures look more like little trial balloons to try to figure out where we stand and how much, what kind of resources can we get in exchange for this threat. Okay, so that's what this looks far more manipulative to me than it looks like an honest, true blue suicidal individual. Now, I could be wrong. Okay, but the way we proceed is we proceed with a reasonable plan that we have to understand that that's their existence and this is our existence. And we have to like map out our best life space. And that includes, in other words, doing what is reasonable and appropriate to try to help their life space, but you know, limiting that in ways that make sense to us. And understanding that to live our lives in a hostage situation where they're constantly putting us in a state of emergency over the fact they might off themselves is absurd. Okay? There comes to a time when it's time to call their bluff, to be supportive and pleasant and firm and have limits, and then be willing to live with the consequences. Okay? That is a position of power. And it's not uncommon in situations like this for it would be exceedingly rare for that to precipitate a suicide. And you can calculate how common suicides are just in general. And it's also extremely useful to know that suicides are basically, for all intents and purposes, almost entirely unpredictable. So anybody that tells you that they can predict that and it would be irresponsible to do this, that, and the other has absolutely no scientific leg to stand on. None. Okay? So it is just as good a bet that you save a suicide from putting up boundaries and essentially being pleasant but firm and then going forth with your own existence and letting them take their chances with reality, not being overly harsh, but being limited about what energy we're going to put their direction, okay? There is not a single scrap of evidence anywhere on earth that says that that is an irresponsible and risky way and increases the likelihood of that suicide. None. Okay? So once you actually start computing the statistical probabilities of suicide and understand what the numbers are, then you start to feel a position of power where you realizing I'm not being irresponsible by setting these limits, and so I'm going to go ahead and set these limits. And guess what? You get to run an experiment. What are the odds that we lay a catastrophic egg right in the middle of day one? The answer to that is infinitesimally small. Okay, so anyway, position of power is going to come with the knowledge and understanding about how these things work, why they work the way they do, and then we proceed with confidence that, you know, we are using the right strategy. Okay? Yeah, this is where we have to, position of power comes with understanding that once we have deeply understood the parameters that are involved and we have devised a strategy, then that's the strategy we play until the evidence overwhelms us that we're not having a good result. Okay, that is the right strategy to play, and that we, you know, we would only revise our strategy in the face of extraordinary evidence against it. So the right strategy is going to be limits, position of power, and a realization that we are not in control of that nervous system and what it may or may not do to itself. Okay. We can be kind and supportive and reasonable, and that's as good a job as we can do. All right. But basically, call me.
Yeah. Well, that's, it's implied by your whole answer there, which really just covers every base. And this is not an uncommon situation. Like, mm-hmm. I think we've both run into this a fair number of times, mm-hmm. and it's definitely, I mean, you you imply it, but I just want to make sure that it's really explicit here that I think often the sort of intuition of parents or family members in this situation is to try to make an appointment with the person in question, to set up an appointment with them to talk to us.
Right.
And this is more about you talking to us and establishing your position of power and boundaries and everything that Doug has gone over here, because there's probably, you know, that not as much fruit to be harvested in the conversation with the person who is putting you in this position.
Right.
Just especially in a case like the one that you've described here. So when we say give Doug a call,
yes,
it's that's addressed to you, not to your daughter.
Right. Perfect.
Thank you.
All right, Nathan, what else we got?
All right. Our next question, dear doctors, as a parent, how do you respond to your child or young adult child who has no recognition of their limitations and personality flaws? This person's on the verge of being fired because they constantly call in sick, they show up late, they don't do their job, but they tell you that they are the best employee and are actually thinking about becoming a manager, and that they're just simply being picked on because they are too pretty and the current manager is jealous how everyone comes to them for help and to answer questions.
That explains it.
Yeah. Or the child who barely passed high school chemistry but says they are going to med school to become a psychiatrist or to work in a lab and create new medications. Even if our...
They'll probably be very successful at that. That sounds like a viable career path for someone who didn't pass chemistry.
Yeah.
Continue, Nathan. I'm sorry. My apologies.
Even if our response is general and vague, like, that's great, but from what I understand, medical school, there's a lot of schooling, that's a lot of science, she gets mad and tells us and all her friends that we told her that she was a loser and a failure, and because of this, she isn't going to med school anymore, and instead, she's stuck in a minimum wage job. Then she gets depressed at what might have been if we hadn't held her back. But if we say nothing, then she tries and fails, or fails to try, and then becomes depressed anyway, but that somehow becomes our fault too.
I got the solution. Are you ready?
Yeah, let's have it.
Psychoanalysis.
It's psychoanalysis every week, maybe twice a week to start. She needs to work through her issues and her trauma and her issues, and especially her issues related to bad parenting.
Oh, yeah.
My sarcasm detectors are going off.
This is just a couple of notches over on the continuum from the whole previous answer. I mean, it's this, we're talking about the same kind of human here.
Yeah.
And the advice is essentially the same. The advice is to manage your own life, put yourself in a position of power, realize that when you're dealing with a human like this, that there's probably no scenario where you do the right thing, because that she's experiencing a lot of failure feedback. And if she runs into failure feedback, i.e. can't get into medical school, has to work a minimum wage job instead, it's very convenient to blame the parents for not being supportive enough to support her dream of going to medical school. If it hadn't played out that way, she'd be complaining to her therapist that you pushed her too much to go to medical school. And she was always feeling too much pressure to achieve in specific ways. And so she had to rebel, and that's why she can't get into medical school. There's a scenario like this. You've got somebody who is always going to respond to a competitive crisis or a competitive dilemma with lashing out and blaming people around them. And as parents, I infer, I think, from this question, I actually, maybe we don't know for sure. But the, you are in the line of fire no matter what you do. And so it's really just about, you know, again, walking that line between being supportive but not letting yourself be held hostage by somebody who is going to run into a lot of difficulty and competitive trouble and be looking for people and places and things to blame for that competitive trouble, as long as those people and places and things are not herself. So it's the general advice here is just to stand your ground and steer clear as much as possible.
I have a way better solution.
More psychoanalysis?
Here's what has to happen. Okay, let's suppose that in times past, I had some gal that I was married to that had a nice pretty face, and then we had a kid, a little boy, and it turned out he had a big nose. Okay? what do we do about it? We blame the person responsible, which would have been me. Now, if you have a little narcissist like this that's an unbelievable pain in the ass, the thing to do is for the two parents to sit down and look at each other and say, okay, who's responsible for this? Somebody's responsible. It might be, hey, listen, you know, this kid's just like, you know, her Aunt Sarah. You know, that's just how it is. It's like, that is how it is. This is obviously a flaming little narcissistic human being. There's not a damn thing they can do about it. We just let them go out in the world and smile and let them bang their head against the wall and be pissed off at everybody. And this is, you know, the good news about people like this is that they keep lawyers employed. It's very, very useful. They serve a function for the American Bar Association that basically a vast majority of civil litigation has to do with people just like this. So thumbs up.
Disagreeable money laundering industrial complex. It's just trade money back and forth with each other.
Exactly. That's what it is. So all kinds of solutions to this problem.
Yeah, you can't, there's no way to win. It's just like, how soon do you cut your losses and accept that?
Yeah.
And stop beating your head against the wall trying to get some kind of feedback that you're a good parent or that you're appreciated or that they're grateful for what you've done for them or any of that. It's never going to happen.
Disagreeable distance all the way down.
Yes.
Your life is, your emotional life is, essentially fed by the food of the personalities of the people around you. Okay. In the same way that your physical body is supported by mostly your diet and your other lifestyle inputs. And so if it turns out that you totally laid an egg, you know what I mean? That you just got yourself a total pain in the ass human, then you did. Okay. And you hope that you didn't go 0-for-1. That's all I can say. You know, I have a lady, one of my very favorite, sweetest ladies in the world, went 0-for-3. Like three totally, you know, essentially carbon copies of the monster that she married and mated with. Too bad. It really is unfortunate. Had another sweet lady went 0-for-1. So all the chips went that the son is a slick, high IQ, super disagreeable sociopath, just like the father was. Okay. So that's a bummer and a half. I've had people go 3-for-4. I've had them go 2-for-4. I've had them go 2-for-3. I've had them go 3-for-3. I've had them go 2-for-2. It's wildcatting in West Texas, folks. And this one is a duster all the way down. That's just what it is.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. So, yeah, it looks like these parents may just have to implement your disagreeable distance strategy.
Oh, yeah. Disagreeable distance all the way down.
Yeah.
That's the only reasonable thing to do.
Yeah.
All right.
And this is, I always kind of have to step back with that political lens, too, and look at the political, what political science would call a political opportunity structure, but is really just the environmental context of any individual who has these kinds of personality characteristics and how likely they are to be expressed in this particular way under different sets of circumstances. And so you take this human and you put them in a more difficult period of human history where, you know, they don't have life comfortably handed to them on a silver platter in ways that their ancestors could only fantasize about.
Yeah.
And they wind up, if they have this predisposition to be this narcissistic, externally blaming, never happy, it's everybody else's fault except for me kind of character. It gets this kind of quality, this sort of like, oh, I need to go talk to my psychoanalyst about it every week kind of quality, rather than, I guess I just need to suck it up and figure out a way to get food on my table next week because no one's going to do it for me.
Yes.
And that's just not something that exists for somebody in this position, because those basic needs are generally taken care of in a way in the modern environment that they just haven't been in any era of human history. So you have what looks like an increased pathology of mm-hmm. this kind of character, and you know what's gone wrong with these kids today? Why are all the kids? What's wrong with all the kids? And it's really this interaction with genetic predisposition that is being unleashed in an environment that can accommodate it in a way that it just would not tolerate it. It would select it right out under different sets of environmental pressures. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you can post it on social media.
I knew
all day.
I just knew it. Yeah, I knew it was worse now.
Well, if the parents are going to get blamed anyway, they might as well do it from a position of power, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they will be blamed anyway, and the sooner they can realize that is true. It really is either you neglected them too much or you pressured them too much. You know, it's like there's no middle ground. If they face competitive failure, it's something must be wrong, and what came before, and you're the one who seems to hold the most responsibility there. So whatever you did, it's
unless, of course, this child succeeds and gets really successful, and that's because they were such a hard worker, and it was all them.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. They. Yes. Totally. Despite all of their difficulties in their childhood.
Yeah. The truth is, you got one life to live and so many hours to live it. And don't throw these little vampires, you know, more of your time than is warranted. Mm-hmm. Even if they're you know, first degree genetic relatives, you gotta honor the value of the disagreeable distance. Mm-hmm. All right, one more.
All right, we'll
Nathan.
Do one more. We're gonna skip down to the one that's a shorter question.
Okay,
dear doctors, what would you estimate is the heritability of how you treat your spouse or significant other? I figure it's a little shorter question here, shorter answer.
Unbelievably high.
Unbelievably.
Yeah.
That's. I mean. Yeah. I don't know what else we need to say
there.
Can you
expand on the
answer?
It's
because it's such a constellation of, well, it's so it's all the heritable aspects of your basic temperament, which are informing how you treat anybody. It's all of the ways that you the way that you're resolving conflict, the goals that you have for yourself, whether you are the kind of person we've described in the previous answer or not, is going to have a huge impact on how you treat your significant other, of course. And those are all heritable characteristics. So the things that might mitigate that are probably going to improve your treatment of your significant other throughout the course of your life, just like people in all things equal become more emotionally stable over the course of their life. So as you have a couple of relationships and learn a couple of lessons about your own distortions and how they might get you into trouble in relationships, you can certainly quote unquote improve how you communicate. You can improve how you go about resolving conflict. You can try to bring a little more attention to those things, but it's pretty much just going to go that way. You're probably not going to become a worse person in terms of how you treat your significant other in most cases, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, I would say there's a certainly the first thing that probably Jen and I think about is we think about the way you're treating whoever that person is has two basically variables to it. One is what's the nature of the CB in the relationship specifically, and then what is your particular personality also. This question, interestingly enough, is there's a third question that effectively they're asking, which isn't even in our, it's not even on our radar, and yet it's actually the number one explanation of any, you know, 99.9% of the therapists on earth and pundits, which is that, oh, well, you imitate how you treat your, you know, you imitate this from watching your own parents. This is insane. This is totally obtuse, and it's wrong. The and folks, it's really worth being right. It's really worth knowing what the truth is about things. You know, the Serenity Prayer, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it's like, God grant me the There you go. The wisdom to know the difference. How on earth would you know the wisdom to know the difference? The answer is that for most of us, for most of all time, wisdom is the accumulated hard knocks of people learning things the hard way, okay? And so you learn them through your own hard knocks, and then you learn through everybody else's hard knocks that, you know, talks about it. That's pretty much what it's been. But there is a third way, and that is that you can achieve wisdom as a derivative of science, if that science is specifically about human nature. And so we now sit at a place where a tremendous amount has been discovered about human nature in the last quarter of a century. It's been denied. It's banned out of textbooks, basically. In other words, it's shouted down. It's ignored. People have their fingers in their ears and screaming that this isn't true. But it is true. Okay, you are a product of evolution, and men and women are strikingly different in a myriad of ways, and individuals are strikingly different from each other in a myriad of ways, and this is based in their genetics. And so what can you change and what you can't change? A hell of a lot you can't change, okay? What can you change? You can change the circumstances that you're in. That you can change, okay? So the question here is, you know, how much is the heritability of how you treat your spouse or your significant other? The truth of the matter is that approaches 100%. Okay? It is very close. In other words, your personality is your personality, and how you're treating that other person close to you, that is certainly partially dependent upon how they're acting and how you value the relationship. But writ large, as Jen Hawk would say, compiled across your lifetime, how you treat those other people or how it is that you are. Okay, so be careful. If you're in a relationship with someone that is very problematic in that relationship, they ain't changing. Okay, that's how that sits inside of the serenity prayer of what you should seek is that wisdom. This is the wisdom. It's hard-won wisdom and fought bitterly. But there it sits in a book called Blueprint by Robert Plumman. Okay, so take heed.
He should really pay us royalties every time we mention it. We recommend this book affiliate link every episode. Yeah, exactly.
Amazon affiliate link.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to it. So next show is going to be our 300th episode. I can't believe it's been that long.
Oh, wow.
And for our listeners, we're going to have some fun questions, not too serious. Probably a little political commentary, I'm sure, Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle.
Yeah.
But just some fun, not non-serious questions. And then you're going to be doing the seminar. So I encourage everybody to go. I'll put the link in the description here for the episode so you guys can go check out the link to sign up for the seminar, but really, really looking forward to it.
All good.
Awesome.
Thank you, Nathan. Good, great job as always.
Thanks, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk. Have a wonderful night. We'll see you real soon.
All right.
You too.
Sounds good.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.